Well, those Saturday night brawls, they rarely amounted to any hard feeling or any grudge things. It's very unusual. Usually it was just all whiskey fights anyway. And come Monday morning, it didn't pay to carry grudges in those days, because come Monday morning, you might be setting chokers with a guy that you were scrapping with Saturday night. And that just isn't going to do it all, so you just forget it and go back to work. And rarely by Monday morning, nobody ever remembered what the fight was about anyway. So I think that probably takes a reason. Well, you see, grudge fights that used to happen on Saturday night, they rarely ever, or these Saturday night brawls, whiskey fights and so forth, they rarely ever turned into grudge fights, grudge remembrances, because time Monday morning come, why, no one could remember what the fight was about anyway. And besides that, you better not have any grudges, because you'd probably be sitting with a guy setting chokers Monday morning, or logging alongside of the same guy that you had a fight with Monday morning. And heck, you just went back to work, cork boots and hangovers and the whole thing. Well, all those days and so forth, they've all changed. The pressure of population, different logging methods, transportation, all home guard shows now, no more camp shows. Railroad logging is gone, and the influx of people, that all changes things, and things have kind of calmed down, and moonshine is unusual in the country now, and you might say that we're past those wild days and in a more civilized era, and really it's better. At my age, I don't think I could stand what used to be. And then my logging days, which was begun 25 years ago, and before that, maybe a little before that, my days as an active logger, I hired, of course, as I said, a number of fellows, local fellows here, and of course all the loggers in the country. You know, you never went to the woods very long, but you never escaped from the woods without some sort of a moniker or so forth. And a lot of times you never really knew the fellow's first name or his last name, but you knew him by his moniker, his nickname. And we had lots of monikers. We had such monikers as Gandhi Donis, he's still alive. Sweet Norgren, he's still alive. Shorty Deathless is still alive. Raunchy Reigns was my moniker. And I'll tell you a little bit about how I got my name, my moniker, Raunchy Reigns. We always went to work early in the morning, and before any of the stores would open up, and lots of times why my day lasted longer than the stores stayed open. And I never had time to get myself a new pair of gloves. I was always walking around the outside of the landing, picking up gloves that the other boys had cast off or thrown out, looking to see if I could find a better pair of gloves than what I was wearing. And so that's how I got my name of Raunchy. And then there was Drag Saw Smitty, and Wild Bill, and Blasphemous Bill, and Hill Billy, and Hook. Hook was a common moniker. Coon Johnson, Corn-Fed Hoodenpile, the Ball Brothers, High Scott, Pete the Pouch, and Piss Tank Jack. And the Ball Brothers, I have to tell you about it. There's three brothers in the last of the 40s. Their name was Franks. And those boys are still alive, and they were logging out there in the burn when we were still salvaging the snags out of the Tillamook burn. And we always called them, boy, they were kind of three brothers, and there wasn't anything they wouldn't do. And they didn't care how they got it done. And they would log in the middle of winter and 4 and 5 feet of snow any way they could get the cat to run. And they'd log in 4 and 5 feet of mud. And they always called them the Ball Brothers. There was High Ball, Speed Ball, and Screwball. And High Scott, of the Scots that live over in the Scoggins Valley. They're old people in this country here from Pioneer Stock. And High was superintendent of Stimson Logging, Stimson Lumber Company Logging for years. And Pete the Pouch and Pistang Jack way. They were a pair of Canadian fallers that worked for me, and they always chummed together and worked together. They worked together and they played together, and they couldn't hardly wait for Saturday to come, because Pete, a fellow by the name of Pete Lebensoff from Vancouver, Canada, he could never, he was always going to town and put her in the pouch, he said. And then it was a partner, Pistang Jack, and always on Monday morning he showed up with his cork boots in his hand and a heck of a hangover, and asked him what he did over the weekend, and you know, he just put up with some old Pistang. So I called him Pistang Jack. Good God, those were some of the characters that were in the country. There was many more of them that have come and gone, and some that I just don't recall their monikers right at the moment. But anyway, I recall some of the stories, some of them lies, some of them the truth here. My dad used to like to tell a story about Paul Bunyan, and there were hundreds and hundreds of stories about Paul Bunyan, the great logger, you know, the big mythical logger. One story my dad liked to tell about Paul Bunyan was after he logged all the way across the United States from Minnesota, and when he come to the Northwest, well, he sent Sailor Bill down the river with the whole outfit and around the South American Horn and back up the West Coast, and he met the logging outfit off the coast of San Francisco. And Paul Bunyan's logging in the Northwest, and he had a fellow logging right next door to him called Double Jawed Murphy. And in the wintertime, where they get together for a big gam in the bunkhouse, the two crews, and of course, Double Jawed Murphy was a braggart sort of fellow, and Paul Bunyan was a very modest person. But they got into an argument about who could make the best Limburger cheese. And Double Jawed Murphy was the braggart kind, and of course, he made the best Limburger. And then finally, Paul's crew, not to be outdone, got Paul to explain how he made Limburger. And of course, he stirred up so much of this and so much of that, and let all set and coagulate and made some more additives of some kind. And then there was a cave up behind the bunkhouse on the side of the mountain there that had just exactly the right temperature, and he'd hang it up in just exactly the same size balls all sacked up, let it cure out just exactly a certain amount of time, and then he would go up and get a bag, a ball of this Limburger cheese and bring it down to the bunkhouse. But he always tested it out. Paul always tested it out before he let anyone sample his Limburger at all. And so finally they asked him, "Oh, Paul, how did you test your Limburger?" "Well," he said, "I just take the burlap back off of it, and I take my knife and I cut off a chunk of it and I throw it out on the bunkhouse floor, and if the dog grabs it and eats it and then turns around and licks his hind end to get the taste out of his mouth, it's all right." And then my dad used to like to get some of these lumber buyers from back east out here, and then he is great. My dad was a great storyteller, and he used to tell about the size of his logging railroad, which was all lies. He'd tell them how big it was out here in the Northwest, and the engineer and the fireman were bringing the load of logs down off of the mountain, and there was a bum riding on the tender behind the Loki, and that bum was about 7 foot high, big, tremendous man. And he come down into the cab and he threatened him. And the fireman got into a fight with him, a scrap ride on the locomotive while he's bringing this load of logs down out of the mountains. And he hit him with a stick of wood and killed him. And the fireman went back in and told the engineer about what had happened. The engineer said, "Well, we got to do something with him. Got to get rid of him somewhere or another. Throw him in the water tank on the tender there." So he threw him in the water tank, and the fireman come back into the cab, and then he thought he'd check his water gauge to see, check the water level in the boiler, and by God, here was this tramp bouncing up and down inside that water gauge. Now that's just how big that logging railroad was. These are some of the truce happenings and some of the logger humor that comes out of the woods that rarely gets to town. And these are true stories that happened in my outfit. I had a crew, and of course they were loggers, you know, and they made up a lot of their own humor and a special type of humor. And I had a fellow that worked for me, old Coon Johnson. And he's now retired, lives down close to Hillsboro someplace, and good calf skinner. He come walking down out of the woods there one day down to the landing, And I said, "What's the matter, Howard?" I said, "The cat break down." And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what happened?" "Well," he said, "they pulled the bullpen right out of the heifer shaft." Now, whatever that means, I don't know. Then, by God, you know, I had a hard-working choker setter work for me, a fellow by the name of Mickey Harden. He's now a logger over in Idaho, and I don't know whether he's retired now or what, but anyhow. And then I had a fellow that he is now retired, a fellow by the name of Shag Bristol, lives in Gales Creek. And Shag was first loading for me, and Mickey Harden was setting chokers, and we were coming in from the woods one night in the candy wagon or the mulligan or the crummy or the crew truck, whatever you want to call it. And Shag Bristol was quite a BSer, and he was telling about when he was loading over on Lida for Lida Logging Company out in the burn, and the big timber that they had, and they were all 2 and 3 log loads, and rarely never went over 4 or 5 log loads. And that went on and on, and finally we were riding in we were just coming into Yam Hill, and we stopped to Crummy, and I'd allow one man to get out and take an order of cold beer, cold soda pop, whatever they wanted, and then get back to Crummy, and we'd head for home. Well, we were leaving Yam Hill, and this Shag Bristol was carrying on about these big logs, and finally Mickey Harden hollered, "Oh, bullshit." And old Shag says, "Well, I'll kiss your ass if it isn't true." And old Mickey never wore anything in the hot summers except just a pair of wool socks, his boots, and his pants, and a shirt, and that's all he wore. And old Mickey just stood right up and threw down his suspenders, and his old hairy butt was hanging out there. And the guys all started laughing, and Coon Johnson was driving the Crummy, and my hooker is a superintendent in the woods. He had a cold beer in his hand, and he just reached right over about 2 seats and just dumped that whole bottle of beer right down the crack of old Mickey's fanny and into his boots and the whole thing, and the whole Crummy got to laughing and raising Cain around there with humor and laughter, and old Coon Johnson darn near took the Crummy right into the ditch with the whole crew. Then sometimes we used to stop at a tavern for a drink on the way home, right down here at Scowgin Valley Junction, and we had right about quitting time, boy, there was a secretary by the name of Donna somebody that worked up the Stimson Lumber Company, and she used to stop in there, and she'd have her evening cocktail and then go on. And we got in there just about the time that she was in there, and Frank Pesha, one of the owner of the place there, he had quite a speech affliction of stuttering. And this Donna, she always liked a screwdriver, which is orange and vodka, or gin, whatever you want there. And so anyway, while she come walking in, and Frank Pesha there with his speech affliction, we were all sitting down at the other end of the bar there having a drink of whiskey, and he says, "Well, hello, Donna, what you gonna have? A screw?" And I'm telling you, the whole place freaking fell apart. And then old Coon Johnson, when we were working in the spring or in the wintertime in the mountains, why, of course you always had your gloves full of mud and your hands muddy. And old Coon Johnson, you have to go to the number one and take a pee. Why, of course you always had mud hanging on the end of your penis when you got through. So it come time to quit, and old Coon Johnson, he'd always say, "Well, let's go home and screw the old lady and get the mud ring off." And then some of the humor lapped over into downtown, and I remember living in Forest Grove. We were working hard the hot summer, and we were hoot alley. That means you're going to work about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You're probably going to have to quit about 9, 10 o'clock in the morning because of the low humidity. And we were hoot alley, and I went to bed about 9 o'clock. I had to get sleep, so I went to bed about 8:30, 9 o'clock. One evening, when my boy come running upstairs, and he said, "Dad, you better come out here in the front yard. And you better come out here and take a look at this thing." So I put on my bathrobe and went down, and by God, here was a mule tied up to the side of my pickup, and it was just kicking the hell out of the thing, and that pickup was rocking back and forth and had the door all kicked in. And I didn't know what to do with that mule, so I got a rope out of the garage and took him down behind the house and tied him up to a tree, and come find out, friends of mine there in Forest Grove had stole that mule from the local mortician and towed him all the way across town and tied him up beside my truck. And the mortician finally found his mule the next day sometime. Anyhow, the mule was gone when I got home. One thing, you know, happened to me here recently. It's so darn funny, I got to tell it. I and my boy, well, of course, my boy is older and he's recent forestry graduate. And we were logging, cleaning up some hardwoods and so forth over the hill here from the house. My house is built on my tree farm here. And we come home here, run over the hill for a sandwich here at the house, and we went back again. We were sitting right alongside the coal deck, and the log skidder was sitting there. And I says to my boy, we say, let's have a cup of coffee this afternoon before we hit the ball. And so we were sitting there, and my boy, pretty soon he says, well, would you look at that, Dad? And he's sitting on the pasture side, and I looked out his side of the window, and by God, here's a three-point buck standing about 35 feet, 40 feet out of the window right there. And this was at the end of the first week of deer season, just this last fall here. So I told him, I said, don't even fart above a whisper. I said, just roll down that window real easy. And I sneaked over the back seat and picked the 30-30 off the gun rack, and I put it right across his chest with the muzzle out of the car, out of the truck. And I never shoot the gun inside the truck. And had it right out of there, and I was going to get a one-shot kill on that deer. And he stopped, and he looked all around, turned around, and then he started to walk back again. And about the time I got ready to touch that 30-30 off, why, he took one more step, and I touched her off, her wham, and I shot the right rear view mirror right off the side of the truck. And that's a true story, and the fact, and there's the mirror right there.
That's great.
So that's how, but anyhow, I felt bad enough about that, but anyhow, it's darn funny. I just couldn't keep, I can never hold a story like that back. It's darn funny. And I didn't feel so bad when I heard about Dick Vaughn, contract logger for Stimson Lumber Company. He up there at Tuttle Point in a rock pit by about 2 weeks before deer season. He bought himself a new deer rifle, and he had a scope on the thing, and he's going to sight it in. So he got up there in that rock pit, and of course his line of sight from that scope is 3 or 4 inches higher than his bore line, and he took a rest right over the hood of his brand new pickup, and he sighted her in, and he touched her off, and he shot about a 2-foot groove right down the hood of his brand new truck. So I didn't feel so bad after that. And I could go on there. Here, you know, I just thought of a funny story here. This is really good. Now, this happened back in when we had one of the reburns of the Tillamook burn, of all of these dead trees and everything laying on the ground, lots of fire hazard. We had a little community over the Wilson River, about 5 miles over the summit towards Tillamook. And we called it Idiotville. There was about 5 or 6 shacks there, and they were always vacant in the wintertime. And in the springtime, why, when there was lots of salvaging yet of the Tillamook burn, logging families would move up there from Tillamook or from Forest Grove, Gales Creek, or Glenwood someplace. Move in there to those old shacks, and they'd stay out there all summer, and the men worked right there, and we called it Idiotville. Well, loggers were, as I say, were great hands to give monikers and nicknames and all that kind of thing like that. But then we had it was either the 45 fire or the 49 fire. I just can't remember which one it was. But we had there was a reporter by the name, I think his name was first name was Frank, but his last name was Sterrett, for the Oregonian. Or was it the Journal? I can't remember. But anyhow, he was a great hand to cover any of these things, and he was a great photographer. Took lots of pictures. So Sterrett come along to this community of Idiotville, which is right alongside the highway, the Forest Grove to Tillamook Highway, the Wilson River. And he thought, well, the forestry was there with trucks, and they were loading these families out and vacating, and God, it was cinders and the heat from the fire was all around, and I'd been there just a few minutes before the Sterrett come along, but anyhow, Sterrett come along there, and he thought he'd interview some of these loggers that were being evacuated and find out, kind of get a little rundown on this community and so forth. And so this one logger, I can't recall the fellow's name, why, he was running around there trying to catch some of his chickens to put them in the truck, And Sterrett was trying to interview him, and Sterrett asked him what the name of this community was. He said, well, it's Pussyville. And so, by golly, I got the rundown of this thing, and Sterrett took his pictures, and I'll be doggone. Now, this is a true story. The following Sunday morning, there was a full page feature of pictures and a story about Pussyville. And the headline across the feature section of this was Pussyville Burns. And that's the truth if I ever told it, and I'll swear it. If you don't believe me, go back to, down to Portland and check it out. The doggonest thing I ever heard of. Laugh, that was a great, that was the most laughter around here. I don't know whether Frank stared at everybody, anyone ever told him he got taken in or not. And then some of the more recent humor takes place up here. Of course, I love a good joke. I don't care whether it's on me or somebody else, just long no one gets hurt. I don't believe in that kind of thing. But in the interim of building this house here, we were living, I and the wife were living in an old farmhouse down here, about a mile down here. And while I'm building this house here, the garage roof out here is always, is all in a styrofoam, which is a good watershed on the roof, besides a good insulator. And it put on under pressure, and it foams up about 2 inches thick and coagulates right there. So it's got a lot of air cells in it. Well, the fellow that was putting it on, the workman's putting it on, put on under pressure, and the lid on his barrel blew off, and some of that stuff foamed up over on the ground and made a pile about maybe 2.5-3 feet across, and kind of in ripples and bumps and looked, and on the ground there about a foot high. And so anyhow, one of the carpenters, a fellow by the name of Mark Yackel, he says, well, that looks just like an elephant shit. So the carpenters around here, they all got to saying, well, God, tomorrow morning is the opening of deer season. What you ought to do is take that up there and put it on Stimson's Road and put a sign up by it, elephant crossing. So by golly, I thought it was a pretty good idea. So I run down the road to the old farmhouse where we living down here, and I grab a piece of plywood and a bucket of yellow paint that I keep to paint the yellow gates, gates yellow around here. And I was painting that sign, elephant crossing, beware elephant crossing, next 200 feet. And the wife came out and looked at it, and she's got quite a little humor by her own right. And she said, well, why don't you put Bigfoot on there? This was at a time when Bigfoot was back in the news up by Hood River someplace. And she said, why don't you put Bigfoot on? Fine. I just wiped her right out, and I put, beware, Bigfoot crossing, next 200 feet. And then I took another sign, and I put on it, Bigfoot was here. And so then I took her up there, and I put that sign on the side of Stimson's Road, and just up above my, where my upper steel gate up here, where the game commission sets up a checkpoint there on Stimson's Road, where my road interconnects with it every year. Put it up the road there where I could watch this thing, and then I put the sign that says Bigfoot was here over on the other side of the road, and I set this big pile of styrofoam over there. And by God, I'm telling you, these dudes coming out from Portland, you wouldn't believe the flip-flops and the antics that they went through. And some of them, for instance, one car come driving out of the woods, a couple of young fellows, maybe in their mid-20s, someplace in there. And they stopped, backed up, took a look at that sign. One fellow got out, and he walked up the road looking for footprints. And then he come back again, and he walked over to the other side, and he looked at that pile of styrofoam there. And it looked like, and it says Bigfoot was here. And then he took his foot and he reached out and touched that pile of crap, what he thought was shit. And he decided he'd been had, and then he gave it a big kick, and it went sailing off into the brush. And I'm telling you, we almost collapsed down the road. It was the doggone scene you ever saw. And then, by golly, they had a lot of these dudes that come out from town. My deer hunting anymore comprises mostly, first day of season, I love to get up here and just BS these dudes coming out from Portland, just something terrible, you know, these big, tall tales. It's about the second day of deer season, and the fella come driving down the road, and he looked kind of bedraggled and tired, and rolled down the window, and I was standing there with my stagged off pants and my cork boots on, and he says, I've been driving for 2 days, and I haven't seen a deer. And I said, well, how much time have you spent hunting? Well, he hadn't even got out of the truck as it happened. And so he says, is any deer in this country? And I said, oh, yes. And he says, well, how do you hunt them here anyhow? And I said, that's easy. I says, you just get out here at the crack of dawn now. You be right here at the crack of dawn. And right when that sun is just tipping up over the hill, and you drive down the road real easy, and don't look for deer. You look for tracks coming off the bank. When you see a track coming off the bank, don't stop the truck. Drive on right down the road about 100, 200 feet. Then you quietly open the door and don't slam the door. You walk back and look at those tracks. And then I give him this big dissertation about tracking. You know, if it's snowing and there's a curl in front of the hoof and it hasn't fell down, remember the air is warming, the sun is coming up. That's a red hot track. If it's fell down, forget it, it's cold. And if it's raining, why, if there's water in his track, forget it, it's cold. But if it's fresh and there'll be no rain in that track and that little curl of mud right in front of his toe, that deer's hot. If it's a frosty morning and that little arch is up in front of that toe right there, it's hot. And I says, you just get on one of those hot tracks and you stay right on it because there's something on the end of every one of them. Geez, this guy got really out of joint about the thing and he was going to whip my butt right there. And finally his partner sitting there poked him in the ribs and he began to laugh and he saw the humor of the thing. Finally this guy began to laugh and got with it. And he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, I'll buy you a drink of whiskey if you can tell me another story like that. And I says, yes, I can. And I says, it's partly lies and partly the truth. And I says, my old grandmother, she's a half-breed Indian girl, and that's the truth. And she used to kill all the deer for the winter larder when her and Granddad Rains had a DLC over back in Idaho. And she used to just, she had an old 45-90 that you could stick your thumb down the end of the barrel, and she'd wait until the last thing in the fall, that crisp weather when you could make a kill, and they didn't have refrigeration those days, and you could hang it up in the meat cooler, and it would stay frosty and cool all winter long, and get a good glaze on that meat, and they had fresh meat all winter. Well, she used to just wait the last thing in fall, and she'd just poke her gun right out the back end of the old cabin, the old homestead cabin, and I've seen that homestead cabin. And now the rest of this is all lies. And she just shoot one shot right in the neck, kill him the first shot every time. But she's well over 100 years old now, and she don't see so good anymore, and now it takes two. Thank God that guy just reached right down the floor of his truck and snaked a bottle of whiskey right off the floor and handed her to me.